As these examples show, the pursuit of megascale and uniformity of systems, combined with speed of rollout, contradicting permaculture principles of prioritising small and slow solutions, inevitably leads to generation of new problems. Further, these examples reflect the assumption that the severity and scale of the climate emergency demands big and fast solutions that only globalised capitalism can provide. This widespread assumption in the environmental mainstream is flawed for several reasons. Firstly, the fastest way to address the climate crisis would be for the global middle class to radically change their behaviour, with policies to support and encourage that change. As we have seen in response to the pandemic, behaviour change can and does happen fast if society decides it is necessary. This can happen much faster than even the most miraculous examples of new infrastructure construction, which itself also depends to a significant degree on behaviour change. Secondly, it's an illusion created from the evidence of the industrial era that all solutions must grow to achieve fossil fuel economies of scale. While rooftop solar might not be quite as economic as solar farms under conventional metrics, the advantages of producing the power where people live makes megascale moot. Small-scale solutions can grow by replication, allowing a live-learn cycle that can improve at each iteration with less of the risks associated with large-scale projects. Modern communication networks allowing learnings to spread globally, even if the degree to which ecologically resilient solutions can be rubber-stamped from one context to another, is more limited than is generally assumed. Thirdly, when assessed holistically and ethically, the best bang for buck in the renewable energy rollout is power for the people without power in the third world, who are also in the front line of climate impacts. By improving their resilience and productivity, we reduce the scale of mass migration, which is one of the long predicted and already begun consequences of climate change. As demonstrated by the appropriate technology movement in the 1970s, these types of technology and implementation require different scale and speed than those provided by global capitalist systems. And these smaller scale, more localised applications provide more employment. Ironically, permaculture design and activism around the world has found that these smaller and slower appropriate technologies are the very models we need in the overdeveloped countries to avoid us constantly turning the solutions back into the same problems. Lastly, it's been shown that the faster scaling up in the manufacture and rollout of renewable energy technology results in increased greenhouse gas emissions in the critical next few decades, even if there are substantial net emissions reductions in over the longer term. The ways in which the problems of scale and speed compound is not necessarily intuitively obvious, especially for societies that have gained from rapid growth for centuries. The evidence is now overwhelming that to avoid the worst consequences of the converging ecological crises, humanity has no choice but to radically downscale the global economy. The question is whether it's possible to do that in a way that minimises the pain and suffering. Maybe the pandemic that has been impacting affluent countries as much or even more than poor countries might provide lessons or even the processes by which humanity might learn how to manage degrowth rather than just collapse. This brief foray into small and slow permaculture design solutions highlights how permaculture design principles are thinking tools to reverse or transform the assumptions we apply, mostly unconsciously, from the heritage of at least 250 years of fossil-fueled modernity. Use and value diversity is another permaculture principle, which, in its more limited application as value indigenous biodiversity, is an environmental orthodoxy. But, as I have said in relation to trees, the monoculture of the mind is more problematic than that of the forest. This monoculture of the mind expresses itself most persistently in the belief that great solutions, from software to earthworks, can be rolled out across cultures and landscapes without regard to the particulars of the context, and that we need to find one big solution that trumps all others and then spread it everywhere, creating new conceptual monocultures, even if they are dressed up in costume to give local flavour. As the wise thinkers in the new renewable energy field have long known, the future of energy supply will not only be distributed, but also diverse. Not just in a diversity of sources, collectively and complementary providing our needs, but also through a diversity of different territories, bioregions and nations characterised by different energy mixes. In agriculture, the last and most important of human activities to be industrialised, conventional approaches to research, development and extension to farmers tend to create mental monocultures that generate the old problems in new forms. To ensure humanity's future, it is imperative that we develop systems finely tuned to the diversity of landscapes and different contexts. This reality demands a different model of innovation, where the farmer, more than the research scientist, bureaucrat, or entrepreneur, is the most important person in the process. While this idea may seem reasonable, in practice it turns our cultural inheritance and power relationships from industrial capitalism on its head and leads to a flowering of diverse solutions that do not necessarily scale or replicate and may remain opaque, even occult, to the outsider. The psychosocial challenges in such a thinking revolution are very deep, to the point where as soon as we grasp the potency of any genuine solution, we can't help ourselves wanting to rubber stamp that solution everywhere. Maybe our cultural history of evangelical religion is a factor in this desperate desire to spread the word of God, or even permaculture, to save the ignorant masses who don't get it. But that's another story. Having scaled the heights of humanity's predicament, I want to return to more modest examples of how we tend to turn solutions into problems, even in permaculture and related networks. Straw bale building originated in the American prairies, where mechanical baling equipment combined with abundant grain straw across horizon to horizon cropping country. With freezing winters and a lack of trees, let alone harvestable timber forests for building, building from straw bales became a low-cost vernacular architecture. Decades later, the technique spread through ecological building networks that were looking for low-cost and low-embodied energy materials that were super-insulating. In Australia, although the value from super-insulated walls is less than in continental climates of the Northern Hemisphere, making use of this cheap, widely available renewable material certainly makes sense in rural areas, although traditional-sized bales are not as common as they once were. While travelling in Japan in 2004, we saw a few examples of experimental straw bale building. Despite the fact that traditional bales of good quality grain straw don't exist as a byproduct of Japanese farming. We even heard about one straw bale house project where the builders imported straw bales from the USA. It doesn't take much to realise transporting such bulky, low-value cargo across the Pacific Ocean plus road transport to and from port is not a very sustainable practice, clearly a case of the solution becoming the problem. A more subtle but widespread example in permaculture-inspired projects relates to the use of building infrastructure in garden farming. Everything including trellises, fences, raised beds, animal pens and enclosures, shade and greenhouses, outside kitchens and all types of irrigation infrastructure from earth swales to complex computer-controlled drip systems. Everywhere in the world, the use of built infrastructure to enhance and diversify productivity is one of the characteristics that distinguishes garden farming, zones 1 and 2 in permaculture site design lingo, from field agriculture, zone 3. By close coupling with human habitation, garden farming can take advantage of microclimates created by sun-reflecting and shade-creating walls, pergola and trellis structures added to buildings to moderate climate, terraces of stone and wood to make use of steep slopes, fences and other enclosures to contain animals, and water flowing from roofs and hard surfaces directed to tanks and ponds for later use or directly to soil absorption. Most importantly of all, existing gravity-fed reticulated water supply systems can ensure water supply for garden farming, potentially long into an energy descent future. Close proximity of housing and settlements to foothill forests, bamboo groves and stone outcrops away from arable fields is another widespread pattern. This allows garden farming to take advantage of low-cost, abundant and/or readily renewable building resources, as well as fuel, organic matter and a wider range of wild medicinal food and fodder species that all contribute to the household and village non-monetary economy. All these infrastructure enhancements are more expensive and difficult to apply to field agriculture, not just because of the orders of magnitude increase in scale. The secondary benefits associated with habitation are less useful in open fields and can be a considerable impediment to rotation of land uses from crops to pasture or changes in equipment. Nevertheless, intensive horticultural production often does involve large and expensive infrastructure. This is a critical issue in financial viability and means modern industrial-scale horticulture is a greater source of greenhouse gas emissions, resource consumption and pollution than more broadacre but simpler field crop systems. This is one of the reasons behind the permaculture strategy of re-ruralising suburbia with intensive horticulture in the form of garden farming, leaving our prime arable farmland for more space-demanding, broadacre field cropping of grains and legumes. From suburban to small farm scale, extensive use of infrastructure is a defining characteristic of permaculture systems. It is well illustrated in the introduction of Mollison's Designer's Manual by the full-page illustration of a permaculture small farm compared to a more conventional design. However, there is a catch. All this infrastructure must be carefully designed and integrated to perform multiple functions. It also requires resources and work to construct, and even with timely maintenance, will degrade. Whether it is by financial or ecological accounting, it makes sense that the productivity, resilience and other benefits from the infrastructure needs to be greater than the costs, otherwise it all becomes part of the problem again. So good permaculture design addresses this issue firstly by copying traditional systems, making use of abundant or quickly renewing resources such as earth, stone, bamboo and small diameter coppice and thinning wood. Living fences and even bridges can be grown rather than built to further lighten the ecological footprint. In modern affluent countries, and even poor ones, creative reuse of timber pallets, old fencing wire, steel reinforcing mesh, sinks and baths, and a myriad of other consumer and industrial discards tends to trump traditional sustainable sources of material, especially in urban areas. Another important strategy is to distinguish between quick-to-build and quick-to-decay structures made from waste or quickly regrowing materials and those that, with maintenance, might last a lifetime and longer, thus justifying high-quality materials and or more care and time to construct. Sometimes permaculture systems can end up looking very messy as repurposed materials, biodegradable and not, litter the landscape. In some projects, a succession of experiments and trials can create a depressing archaeology that successive owners and occupiers tend to clear away as the failings of the past. Unfortunately, it is quite common to see new materials such as galvanised wire fixed to poorly constructed fences, new polypipe irrigation systems laid out to establish tree plantations only to be chopped up by slashers, and new plastic and metal tools left in the weather to degrade. It's always important to ask, what was the productivity, or at least learning, that justified these resources being extracted from Mother Earth, or justified by the more commonly considered metric of greenhouse gas emissions generated? This critical appraisal of permaculture-inspired designs might seem a little harsh, and to some extent it is. If we compare the amateur dabbling at food production, supported by trips to the local tip and occasional purchased materials at the hardware, to other hobbies and pastimes such as power boating with the odd fish catch, let alone going to the gym to get fit, or serious dysfunction like spending time at the pokies, then even the most dysfunctional efforts at a permaculture designed garden might seem a great improvement. On the other hand, people engaged in recreational activities are not generally claiming what they are doing is a contribution to saving the planet, a marker of significant self-reliance, or a step towards a more equitable world. Whereas we permies like to think we are doing all three while having more fun than people following their exercise regime at the gym. To zoom in more closely on how the solution can progressively turn into the problem when we are not paying attention, consider the raised garden bed, one of the most ubiquitous infrastructures in permaculture design gardens. Mounded beds have many advantages, even in field agriculture, but use extra space in the batter slope, which is subject to erosion by water and or scratching birds. Constructed sides turn the mounded bed into a raised bed, which is more convenient to work and can allow gardening over contaminated soils. The balance between durability and renewability mentioned before is a big issue in making raised beds. The higher the raised bed, the greater the outward force, especially in clay soils prone to shrinking and swelling. Garden soil rich in organic matter and nutrients rapidly decays all but the most durable wood. A variety of salvaged materials and or readily renewable materials can reduce the ecological footprint, while intensively managed garden beds of a modest size can produce a ton of food, literally, over their limited life expectancy. The huge increase in garden farming, permaculture inspired and otherwise, has led to commercial raised garden bed systems constructed from new materials. Some of the best of these systems use naturally durable wood salvaged from farm shelterbelt trees and can last for decades. The next step in intensification is the wicking bed, which radically reduces the water needed and allows vegetable production where invasive tree roots would otherwise be a serious constraint. However, this requires a container or membrane. The best commercial options use a high-quality membrane, a considerable extra cost, but one that may be justified as appropriately responding to the challenge of fresh veggie production in the household economy. As the status of homegrown veggies has become mainstream, the hardware stores now sell all plastic micro wicking bed veggie gardens complete with mesh net covers to keep out pest insects and birds. By this stage, the intensification of infrastructure is turning the solution of garden farming into the same problem of ecological impact and degradation, perhaps as great as conventional production purchased at the supermarket. I think it would probably be better for the environmentally aware householder to buy veggies from a commercial producer using simple but space-demanding field farming techniques, preferably local and organic via a farmer's market or community-supported agriculture, CSA. Can I imagine a scenario where such veggie-growing systems might be justified from a permaculture perspective? For those living in apartments with a sun-facing balcony, the personal well-being from growing a few greens and herbs might tip the balance. By way of analogy, in A Critique of the Embodied Energy of Attached Solar Greenhouses compared to any reduction in residential apartment and house heating in Scandinavia at the 1994 European Permaculture Convergence, the presenter pointed out that being able to read a book on a winter's day without artificial light can be enough to prevent a Swede jumping on a plane to Spain for the winter, and that really does save a lot of energy. Because fossil fuel-powered affluence has created such possibilities unimagined by previous generations, there are many cases where novel permaculture-inspired designs ameliorate dysfunction and hopefully present a transition process from irresponsible consumption to empowered permaculture productivity. Imagine a young child living in an apartment engaged with nature and producing food to contribute to the household economy, gaining a life goal to become a farmer, a potentially huge social capital return on investments by parents making the best of their situation. Of course, the micro wicking bed from the hardware store is not the extreme end of resource-intensive food production, even leaving aside the frankenfoods of lab-grown meat and other industrial responses to the food system crisis. Indoor hydro-cultivation under artificial light, supplying ridiculously inflated prices for illegal cannabis, might contribute to the illusion that projects to grow food in such systems could be one of the ways to feed high-density cities in the future. This is truly a case of the solution turning into an even worse problem of resource consumption and environmental impact. Apart from escalating complexities in managing fertility and pests in these systems, using renewable energy to produce enough light to sustain plant growth of high-yielding vegetables and other plants is never likely to add up energetically. While it's easy to be scathing about the ways in which even well-educated sustainability professionals sometimes promote environmental solutions that don't pass muster from a grounded and holistic permaculture perspective, The forces reinventing ecological dysfunctional behaviours in new forms continue to influence everyone in modern affluent societies. In nature and society, powerful positive feedback loops reinforce well-proven patterns, but these are usually balanced by negative feedback loops that constrain excesses of anything. Unfortunately, decades of growth in resource consumption and economic growth, driven by positive feedback loops in what sustainability writer Darren Quailman calls e-civilization, are driving us towards collapse. French collapsologist theorists Cevin and Stevens speak of structural lock as one line of evidence that they explore in the book, How Everything Can Collapse. This occurs when dominant players or modes in any field gain a near monopoly over mentality and markets, preventing alternative players or modes emerging. They mention the substantial and globally recognised evidence that organic agriculture is more energy efficient than chemical and genetically engineered agriculture, but that funding and research remains focused primarily towards more refinements of those dead ends for future food production. This lock is very complex, involving technical, psychological, and institutional factors. Using the permaculture design principles framework, lock-in results from a failure to value small, slow, diverse, and marginal responses while focusing too much on obtaining an immediate and easily measurable yield and ignoring negative feedback about prevailing means. So in this serious situation, is there any hope for a prosperous way down from the fossil fuel energy peak to a more biologically based and equitable economy, sustaining human needs rather than wants and addictions, and nurturing a flowering of personal and communal non-material human development and well-being? While I believe the elements of this utopian vision are still technically possible, they are more likely to come about by the viral spread of modest efforts at resilience than grand schemes to fix the world with novel technologies. However, it is clear that short of catastrophic collapse scenarios, well-intentioned and not so well-intentioned grand schemes to save the world are already being implemented. I believe most of these efforts will unfortunately repeat the patterns of the past, turning apparent solutions into novel problems. Amongst the diversity of biotech innovations, I think two stand out as powerful enough to significantly help ameliorate the global crisis. And inevitably, both could be corrupted by the patterns of the past if humanity fails to shrug off the thinking of industrial capitalism. These are biochar for regenerative agriculture and marine permaculture for regenerative oceanic commons. Both have indigenous and traditional models, a growing body of research and practice supporting novel applications, are capable of addressing multiple aspects of the global crisis, and can be accessible at household, community, and small enterprise scale to enhance local, resilient, redistributive economies. Biochar is charcoal made and prepared to increase the water and nutrient holding capacity and microbiological activity of agriculturally productive soil. The multiple benefits include increasing resilience to climate change and increasing crop yields and quality, and consequently human health and well-being. In the process, biochar sequesters carbon more permanently than traditional organic farming techniques, and thus has the potential to play a major role in reversing dangerous climate change, amongst other ecological crises. The process of making biochar releases the volatile energy in woody and other biomass. Wood gasification technology can capture this otherwise wasted energy and use it to create electricity, provide heat, and power vehicles. While the technology to do this was last widely used during the fuel shortages of World War II, in recent years, higher energy costs and climate change have driven renewed research and further improvements. Perhaps the greatest sticking point in the widespread application of this technology is the understandable fear that forests and other sources of biomass will be hoovered up, turning yet another renewable technology into an even larger cause of ecological destruction. However, globalised industrial capitalism pursuing real and imagined economies of scale, unrestrained by sustainable yields of surplus biomass, is the real threat, not the technology. Sustainable yields of woody biomass are a natural byproduct of ecological sustainable forestry anywhere rainfall is adequate, and especially where fire ecologies periodically consume surplus forest biomass in managed and/or destructive bushfires. Ecologically sustainable forestry prioritises maintenance of ecosystem services, biodiversity, and high-value yields from trees over woody biomass for energy, biochar, and other low-value uses such as paper. But forest managers around the world understand that thinning dense regrowth accelerates ecological maturity, increases bushfire resilience, improves landscape amenity, and provides high-quality timber and other yields for future generations. In the process, it generates large amounts of small-diameter, low-grade wood. Having a use for that wood incentivizes the work of thinning. As mentioned previously, large monocultures of fast-growing trees covering the landscape are a solution turning back into a problem. This is further compounded when blue gum plantations fail to satisfy financial and growth rate expectations, leading to them being bulldozed and burnt, thereby returning vast amounts of carbon to the atmosphere, a tragic symbol of Australia's dysfunctional relationship with trees and forests. Our own small efforts at sustainable native forestry over the last 25 years at Friars Forest Eco Village are set to take the next step beyond sustainable yields of honey, durable timber posts, and firewood. This will make better use of chipped tree thinnings and heads for wood gasification, for biochar byproduct, for permaculture designed garden farming. Our project aims to demonstrate two important applications of gasification technology on land adjacent to Friars Forest, owned by the company Friars Forest Research and Development that did the original Eco Village development in the 1990s. The first is hybrid wood gas electric vehicles suitable for farm and forest management. We believe the electric conversion of light trucks can avoid the need for massive battery banks by use of lift-on, lift-off wood gas power plants to extend range and power equipment, and power equipment such as cranes and chippers. The second is farm and local community power systems combining rooftop solar with wood gas standby generation for cloudy weather conditions and high local demands, in addition to heat for food processing, timber drying, and other house, farm, and small business enterprises. These systems can be autonomous or grid connected. By demonstrating these modest scale systems, we hope to establish a working model demonstrating how dispatchable wood energy is complementary to the intermittent renewables of wind and solar, especially in rural and regional Australia. In the same way that rooftop solar allowed Australians to recognise solar energy in their lives, human-scale biomass systems are needed for Australians to understand the potential of biomass energy. There are so many possibilities for local businesses in retrofitting our existing stock of vehicles and manufacturing gasification gear locally, rather than just being consumers of panels, turbines, batteries and cars made by global corporations. It is ironic that the search for more sustainable energy and transport could be the driver for getting our act together in husbanding the land as both the source and the sink for the whole process. Sensitive and continuous management of our regrowth and planted forests as the source, and biochar-enhanced microbially active soils as the carbon sink to provide healthy food from garden and local farming. It doesn't matter whether we are focused on the local solutions that provide abundance and resilience in a changing world, or worried about how the global limits to growth can be navigated, permaculture ethics and design principles are tools we need to grasp the nettle of opportunity and avoid the dysfunction of globalised monocultures of the mind. But to avoid global industrial capital yet again bastardising our solutions, it's essential that the models we develop on private land organically replicate to regenerate our more extensive forests to ensure future governments cannot hand over our commons to globalised capital interests. Brian von Herzen of the Climate Foundation coined the term marine permaculture to describe systems to grow kelp forests that can be harvested for food, feed and fertiliser, sequester carbon and create habitat to support thriving and diverse fish populations. Beyond restoration of kelp forests already lost to warming oceans, von Herzen's vision extends to colonising open water environments by artificial upwelling of cold, nutrient-rich water from lower levels. By creating kelp forest ecosystems where none existed, these projects, proposals and visions are analogous to early permaculture visions of terrestrial forests that would restore degraded and desert landscapes with species able to ameliorate the local and even bioregional climate while providing abundant food, fodder, fuel and structural materials for people. But nature's design rules and limits that define permaculture in marine environments are quite different to the terrestrial realm. Seaweeds, especially the fast-growing and massive kelp species of temperate climate regions, need a substrate close enough to the surface to ensure adequate light for photosynthesis. In nature, this occurs along coastlines where shallow depth and wave turbulence combined with runoff from rivers to provide necessary nutrients. In the same way that wharves, offshore rigs and wrecks can provide artificial reefs to support shellfish, coral and associated fish life, designed submerged structures can provide the substrate for kelp forests away from the coasts. With a reduced impact of storm surges, kelp growth can be regulated by herbivorous fish grazing and harvesting. Nutrients can be supplied or supplemented by irrigation from deep, nutrient-rich colder water, the pumping of which may even be possible using diffuse energy in the thermal gradient between warmer surface and colder deep water. Fast-growing kelps sequester carbon at a faster rate than forest trees. Kelps can then be refined into bio-oil fuels or cut and let sink into deep ocean storage on a scale to match that of the climate emergency. Von Herzen sees marine permaculture as having the potential to steer the Earth back to a safe climate without the risk of most forms of geoengineering. However, permaculture principles suggest starting with more modest inshore seaweed farming enterprises at the hectare scale before the development of 100 hectare arrays in the open ocean. Naturally enough, vast operations in the oceanic commons, subject to the laws of the sea rather than nation-state laws, raises all sorts of alarm bells for many, and the risks of this solution creating novel, foreseen and unforeseen problems if the design rules of globalised industrial capitalism drive the process. I have been participating in discussions and documentation with Brian von Herzen and Scott Spillis from University of Queensland in a project to articulate permaculture ethics and design principles as a framework to guide not just seaweed farming projects, but more generally in what's called the blue economy, focusing on the resources of the ocean to sustain humanity. Much of the government and corporate promotion and effort to develop the blue economy shows all the signs of making the mistakes of industrial aquaculture and more generally of industrial agriculture. We hope to draw in experts in diverse aspects of oceanic conservation, marine resource management, and mariculture to support a framework that can hopefully guide fisher folk, mariners, consumers, investors, and policymakers towards virtuous cycles of regenerative abundance rather than repeating vicious cycles of greed, simplification of nature's diversity, over-harvesting, and inequity in access to and control of nature's abundance. Our vision includes the reinvigoration and flowering of indigenous and traditional cultures of seafaring and dwelling peoples using new technology and communications systems to regenerate cultures of flow in tune with the oceanic realm, where access is more important than ownership. It is just possible that what we learn in the oceanic commons might inform and reform how we harmonise husbandry of the terrestrial commons where the vast majority of humanity dwells. Our ancestors' mastery of fire, to use wood to cook, keep warm, hunt and husband the landscape so many generations ago, was the start of a long road that led to fossil-fueled fire and the climate crisis. At the same time that we kick the fossil fuel habit, it is equally essential that we capture and store carbon both on land and in the ocean. It is perhaps ironic that relearning mastery of the finer arts of fire may be both a key to soil-based carbon sequestration and provision of modest energy needs through the crisis. And it is no accident that Australia, as the continent where the art and science of fire was evolved to the highest levels by Indigenous custodians, might play a central role in restoring that balance between earth, air, fire and water. The creativity of humanity is being sorely tested, working out how to thrive, doing less with less, find new ways to turn waste and dysfunction into opportunities to replicate what works and develop the humility to accept the predicament to which we must gracefully adapt. To survive and thrive through the era of energy descent, humanity as a whole must relearn the indigenous wisdom that avoids turning our best solutions into the same old problems.